Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Hello, we're very pleased today to be meeting with Ben Crewe, Susie Hulley and Serena Wright to talk about their research and their recent book, Life Imprisonment, From Young Adulthood, Adaptation, Identity and Time. So would you like to just go round and introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Dr. Serena Wright. I'm a lecturer in criminology at Royal Holloway, University of London.
Great, good to meet you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susie Hulley. I'm a Senior Research Associate at the Institute of Criminology at the University of Cambridge.
And I'm Ben Crewe. I'm Professor of Penology and Criminal Justice and also Deputy Director of the Prisons Research Centre at the Institute of Criminology, Cambridge University.
Hi, it's really good to have all three of you here today. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Thanks very much indeed. In 2011, Ben, you seem to report that conditions were better in our prisons insofar as they were less brutal, but that there was a different kind of oppression which you described in the terms depth, weight and tightness. Do you still think conditions are better and do you still use those terms?
Well, yes and no. So I guess that article, that piece of writing that you're referring to came out of a piece of research I had done a few years earlier. And before I'd done that research, a lot of the reading I'd done that was based on research conducted in the 70s and 80s was about brutality or the outright abuse of power. And what I found when I did my research, my first main bit of research in prisons, which was in around 2003, was that prisoners weren't talking a great deal about brutality or the abuse of power. And actually what they were describing was quite a different configuration of power. And I can recall a couple of conversations with lifers who talked with great eloquence about some of those shifts. One of them talked about a shift from a much more authoritarian culture to one that was softer but much harder to negotiate. And the other one I remember saying to me, well, in the past, the things that caused prisoners to protest were things like visits being cancelled or family members being treated badly on visits or very poor quality food or lack of time out of cell. And at that time, what he said was, well, those things aren't really issues anymore, that the prison service or the prison system has become much less brutal and much more decent. And so what I wanted to do was provide a kind of vocabulary to describe the texture of imprisonment. And so I, drawing on work by other scholars and then sort of trying to build on it myself, I started using these terms depth, weight and tightness. And so depth is really about distance from normality, from the outside world. So that includes things like control, restriction, but also the degree to which prisoners might feel just cut off from or submerged beneath the surface of freedom. And so some of that is about whether external visitors come into the prison, whether there are normal activities that you can engage in and so on. Weight is about interpersonal relationships and treatment. So that's mainly about the relationships between prisoners and officers, but also the basic physical conditions that prisoners live in. And tightness was a term that I started to use to try to describe the softer forms of power that are rooted in things like risk assessments and the fact that so much gets written down about prisoners, particularly those serving indeterminate sentences. And what prisoners felt was that that it was no longer sufficient for them to just be obedient. They had to actively engage with the prison or with their sentence, and that was oppressive in a rather different kind of way. Or that reports by psychologists meant that they felt that their identities were what were being sort of incarcerated, in a sense. So the vocabulary was designed to try to help conceptualize different aspects of imprisonment and of power within prisons. But to go back to your question, I think I was probably a bit optimistic at the time that in my assumption that some of the basics had improved. I think, I mean, you'll be very aware of this, but I think mainly because of financial cuts in staffing, I think there are some aspects of imprisonment that have deteriorated significantly in recent years, particularly with regard to safety, issues relating to drug use, and just the availability and experience of staff. So I think these terms that I and others have used are still quite productive, still I think very useful, but I think it's also the case that there's been a bit of a return to some forms of, not necessarily indecency, but really poor quality conditions, crumbling infrastructure in prisons, and just a fairly bleak everyday experience for lots of people, particularly in local prisons and Category C prisons.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I certainly recognise that deterioration in staffing and other related matters since 2011. Yeah. But prior to that, it seemed to me that from about the turn of the century to about 2010, there was a marked increase in security measures and the loss of many things that were associated with that, like release on temporary license, for example, that virtually disappeared over that kind of period.
Yes, and I mean, it's particularly relevant to lots of the men and women in our study, because the original idea of the high security prisons was that you would have a liberal regime within a secure perimeter. I think the perimeter has become more secure, but the environment in some ways has become less liberal. And there are some quite good reasons for that, in that there were escapes from prisons in the 1990s and arguably insufficient control. But in all sorts of ways, I think the conditions of the men and women who we interviewed in our study have become sort of tighter and deeper and in some ways heavier, even though there have also been improvements in lots of other areas. So it's quite a complex picture.
Do you think, I mean, I recognise what you're saying there about kind of the impact of escapes, for instance, and serious incidents on the overall culture within an organisation. It's almost like they leave a bruise on the organisation, which doesn't really get resolved. And I suppose it seems as though institutions try and solve that by just beefing up security rather than trying to actually process what's happened and make meaning from it in a richer way.
Yes, I mean, I'm quite sympathetic to the argument that I've heard practitioners use, which is that you can't have high security prisons that it's easy for people to escape from. And certainly there was a period when nobody seemed to know that, you know, the figures, there were quite a lot of escapes a couple of, you know, two or three decades ago. And I can see why the prison service needed to prevent those things happening, not just because of the political embarrassment, but you know, custody is their primary objective. But I also agree that sometimes there's that prisons seem to suffer more than many other public institutions from the swing of the pendulum being very, very strong. Maybe that's a mixed metaphor, but it's quite hard to get the balance right, I guess, and quite often it seems as though signal events when things go badly wrong, and of course things go really badly, when things go wrong in prisons, they do go really badly wrong, that quite often there's a very strong reaction to that produces a new kind of problem in a different area.
Yeah, so I think that we did see that very much in the release on temporary license and the ways in which that was restricted and pulled back following some, as Ben said, you know, very significant and very horrendous events that happened, and but once that gets pulled back in, once those restrictions happen, and they did have, you know, a significant impact on some of the life sentence prisoners that we were interviewing, it seems quite difficult for them to accept, I think, that because, and particularly for the women, that because two or three men in particular did some horrendous things when they were out on license, that the entire regime around Rottle closes down, that opportunities are lost, that progress is lost. And when you, I guess, when you are looking at a minimum sentence of 15, 20, 25 years, and, you know, almost from the time you start, you're looking towards the time you're getting out, that every minute counts.
Yeah. So, moving on, prior to your book, you produced a number of very interesting papers 5 or 6 years ago, and in one of them you talk about suppression, denial and sublimation. And as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, which I have been, it's unusual to hear those terms in the field of criminal justice these days. So can you say what you were meaning by these terms and how they relate to the project that you were doing at that time?
Yeah, thank you, David. And I hope that it would certainly be interesting afterwards to hear your reflections on that. You know, I hope that we did those terms justice from a psychoanalytic viewpoint. I think that really that came out of when we started to analyse the data, particularly about the, you know, the narratives of the individuals that were at the early stage of their sentence. I think, you know, we're talking about a subset of people who typically, because of our sampling kind of strategy and criteria, were typically younger than 30, they'd spent less than 5 years in prison, and they were serving at least 15 years in custody and been convicted under the age of 25. And so I think that we were all kind of feeling, looking at this data, that while there was, you know, a rich history of prison sociology out there, a lot of well conceptualized and thought through stuff on the pains of imprisonment, a lot of it just didn't really seem to fit what we were seeing. You know, the language of coping and adaptation about those quite conscious and proactive choices just didn't really seem to gel with what we were seeing, which was really people both kind of psychologically and somewhat subconsciously, it seemed, in some cases kind of barricading themselves against these kind of crushing implications for the self of being given this incredibly long life sentence that in some cases was almost as long as they'd been alive to the point of conviction, and that it was for a murder. You know, and I think, you know, we looked at some of the literature around kind of maladaptations. You know, Hans Tock has written quite a lot about that, that could have been quite useful. But I think that, you know, it's difficult to talk about those things as maladaptive. They might well be in later years when it comes to parole. But at that time, it served exactly the purpose they needed it to, right, which was blocking out and pushing away the things that people couldn't bear to think about. And basically people were just in that kind of survival mode. And so I think, you know, as far as we understood it, Freud's language of these kind of defense mechanisms of the ego, of the psyche, that kind of that way that you needed to protect yourself, was something that, you know, particularly for this group, when the criminal justice system was telling them that their life was over, essentially, as far as they could see it, at a time when society was telling them their life should have just been beginning. And so I think, you know, Freud's model at that point allowed us to really convey the ways in which people kind of suppressed those pains through substance use or through sleep. The way that they used kind of, I guess, denial to talk differently about, kind of re-narrate what happened with the offence or kind of re-narrate the impact of time. It was quite interesting to people using kind of cognitive strategies of kind of saying, well, yeah, I've got 16 years, but I don't think of it like that. I think of it as like 4 World Cups or 4 Olympics, you know. So, I'll do 8 years here, or I'll do 10 years here, and and then I'll start kind of getting towards the halfway point, and then I'll have some, I'll do some courses. By that point, I'll be heading towards open. And so, yeah, it was really difficult for them to think about those things without kind of trying to deny or reconstruct them in some way. While there were some who, you know, in Freud's language, sublimated that experience and tried to channel those things quite positively at that early stage by, you know, saying, well, I better make the use of this, both for me and the person whose life I've taken. And I can do education, and I can do good with this world. I can do good with my life. It was quite unusual at that early point when everyone was so overwhelmed.
And I was just going to add that the issue of denial was really, really interesting, because I think it's often used in relation to people in prison to suggest a really conscious kind of pretending that you haven't committed the offence. Whereas, because we interviewed people at various different sentence stages, that meant some of the people who had served quite a lot of time in their sentence were able to reflect back on the early years of their sentence. And quite often they would say things like, I couldn't accept for myself that I had been capable of committing this offence. In other words, I wasn't pretending that I hadn't done it exactly. Psychologically, at some level, I couldn't allow myself to believe it or to acknowledge it. And so that language around denial was, or that discussion of denial felt really important to us, that these were quite deep-rooted psychological mechanisms rather than really conscious ways of trying to manipulate the system, for example.
Mm-hmm. I share David's response, though, actually, to seeing you use those terms in a paper. That actually, it's really fascinating, because I think because people do rarely talk about defence mechanisms in prisons and in the criminal justice system. So actually, applied psychology in all other areas, including, for instance, in business, it's increasingly popular to talk about defence mechanisms. In clinical psychology, it's very commonplace for people to think about defence mechanisms. But actually, you're talking about sort of like really kind of like something that's the core of psychological thinking, and yet in some ways has been a bit absent from how we think about the criminal justice system. And I wondered what it was about you guys that enabled you to even be thinking about these concepts and bringing them into your work.
I would say probably my A-level in psychology probably had something to do with it, and an extensive history of having counselling, I guess. I would suggest that those things, for me anyway, I guess would guide me to look towards that kind of body of literature for answers that I think through our discussions we weren't finding right in the penology literature.
I also think that it might be because we've said in some of our writing that the offence of murder is just such a significant offence that it forced us to kind of introduce language that made sense of that, because I think a lot of the sociological literature in prisons has not considered the offence as central to the analysis, but it had to be because it was just so prevalent in the prisoners' narratives. So I think sort of what people were defending themselves against was, you know, were that we've referred to it as the offence time nexus, but, you know, both the overwhelming nature of the offence, whether that's them committing the offence or being present at, because obviously around half of our sample were convicted using joint enterprise, so might not have actually perpetrated the offence itself, but might have been present at a murder. Mm-hmm. But then alongside that was the immense amount of time that they were expecting to be in custody. And it was those two things, I think, that they were particularly defending against in a way that might be slightly different if you're convicted of a different offence and or serving a much lighter sentence.
I think it's really interesting to hear those explanations. And I suppose particularly found it interesting, Serena, to hear you talk about sort of thinking about the impact of maybe having your own therapy, what that's enabled you to bring, because I think quite often people are employed as psychologists but perhaps aren't terribly psychologically minded in terms of their thinking. And I think the criminal justice system does seem to at times force a bit of black and white thinking, and I think the more able we are to think about things in truly psychological ways, the easier perhaps it is to sometimes come up with adaptive solutions or different ways of construing things. So yeah, just was curious about that. Thank you.
One of the things that we found slightly tricky to write about, but felt quite important to us, was that people that had been involved in a murder were often quite traumatized by the nature of that murder itself, because it sounds slightly insensitive to suggest that you can be traumatized by a murder that you've perpetrated or been involved in. But that was certainly the case with lots of our interviewees who were having flashbacks or feelings of dissociation, or talked to us about just lots of sensory dimensions that sounded quite like post-traumatic stress disorder, that were to do with as Susie said, that the offence of murder just is a very particular kind of thing. It's not easy to discuss that without there are lots of landmines that you can step in terms of sensitivity, but it was undoubtedly the case that lots of our research participants were themselves traumatized, as Susie said, partly by getting such a long sentence, but more often by what it was that they had witnessed or done, and coming to terms with what people said to us once they'd served a few years of the sentence was that coming to terms with the offence of murder was much harder than and took much longer than coming to terms with being given a life-changing sentence.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I was just going to say, I think absolutely to echo what Ben and Susie have said, that idea of not being able to account for what was going on in the criminological literature, and that point about post-traumatic stress. We were hearing stories that were about individuals experiencing these kind of trigger situations where, you know, if there had been, say, fire involved in their offence, that they couldn't stand it when anyone lit a cigarette near them or flicked a lighter, that they would have the most awful, intrusive thoughts and recollections that they couldn't get rid of, that they would have these flashbacks, you know, hallucinations, nightmares, and so I think that, again, as Susie and Ben said, really pushed us to look towards a very different literature that looked very much at the psychosensory experience of what was happening for our participants.
Yeah, I certainly recognise what you're saying in terms of people being traumatised by what they've done or what they've witnessed. I'm sure you do too, David, from your experiences at Grendon. I'm wondering whether I could just ask, it was a question I was going to ask later actually, but I'm just, given that we're talking about this process of coming to terms with being a murderer that you describe in your paper, and I wonder how that sits alongside current notions that denial might not make people more risky, because you might be using denial in a different way than how some other academics have written about denial. Sure. So as you were talking, I was, I just wondered if you could talk us through what that process is of coming to terms with being a murderer. You're referring to it, but in your papers, you talk about that process in quite a clear way. And I wondered if you could talk us through that. And I also wondered, given the references to denial, how you're thinking about denial might sit alongside current notions that denial of offences doesn't mean that someone's continuing to pose a risk.
I think it's harder to answer that second question than the first. Maybe we'll come back to that. When I've read back through the book, one of the things I've been struck by is how much it's about emotions and the processing of emotions. And obviously in this case, a lot of that is to do with shame. And we were very struck by the consistency with which our interviewees, once they had got beyond the first few years of their sentence, talked with sincerity, we felt, about feeling ashamed about what they had done or been involved with. And obviously that was different for some people who, especially those who were convicted under joint enterprise and who felt that the sentence and the conviction were just illegitimate. But if you take them out of the picture, people were genuinely, a great deal of the conversations that we had with the people who were a few years into their sentence were about existential issues to do with what it meant to have taken someone else's life and in doing so have your own life radically reshaped. And people wanted to talk to us about, so I guess there are two elements to that. One is the questions that people were pondering were, you know, how is it that I've come to be in this situation? How was I capable of perpetrating this act? What do I want to become? But also there was some deeper emotional processing going on for lots of people. So sometimes that wasn't even about the offence itself. That was also about things that had happened in their life prior to imprisonment. And that meant that things like therapy were actually really significant, or therapeutic input was often very significant, because it often kick-started a broader process of coming to terms with one's circumstances. But certainly people coming to terms with the offence seemed to mean acknowledging it, so acknowledging one's involvement in the offence, but also being able to move on from it. And that's quite complicated. What that means is not playing it down or pretending it didn't happen, but not being completely defined by this one thing. And lots of interviewees talked very powerfully about what that really meant, that they you know, they were often really troubled, really haunted by what they had done, but they also had to be forward facing, and that meant coming to terms is quite a good phrase, I guess. Just accepting that you've done something, trying to find therefore a way of sort of absorbing it into your sense of self or your sense of your own sort of biographical narrative, but also finding something that could sustain you moving forward that was independent of that too.
Yeah, can I just fill in the gap about the people who are convicted of joint enterprise, because that was quite a different sort of coming to terms. That was about coming to terms with your conviction as much as anything else. And obviously you are convicted of murder, and for secondary parties, they might not necessarily have perpetrated the final blow, or, you know, they might have been present, but they might not have been present at the offence. So what we found there was that they generally sort of narrated joint enterprise as not legitimate, you know, as quite an unfair law. But over time, in order to sort of make sense of their long-term imprisonment, they had to find ways to kind of come to terms with what had happened to them, or certainly to make sense of their time in custody. And so they did that by either, for example, thinking about the sort of accumulated guilt of other offences. So, well, yeah, I did do this and this in the past, and I never got caught for that, so I suppose this is kind of my karma for that kind of for the offences I've committed of the past. Or they talked about, they kind of amplified their contribution to the offence. So, you know, if I hadn't have told my co-defendant that this man had raped me, then he wouldn't have gone on to kill him. So therefore, I suppose I did, you know, I did kind of contribute to the end result. Or they talked about their kind of failure to act. So, you know, I suppose I didn't phone the police when I saw this thing kicking off, and I suppose that means that I'm, you know, guilty of something. And often, I mean, the kind of interesting thing with joint enterprise is that people would often say they were guilty of something. They were just frustrated because they did not feel that they were guilty of murder. And it was about kind of unfair labelling as much as anything, you know, that I'm going to have to come out of prison and explain to people where I've been for the last 15, 20 years and explain that I'm convicted of murder, but have this very long conversation about what that meant in reality for them, because of all the assumptions and inferences that are made about a person who's convicted of murder.
I think from what you said, Naomi, and from the from what you've been reading, I think just going back to what Ben said, I guess we were hopefully using denial in a Freudian sense, in that way of trying to think differently about this thing that was about you that you couldn't bear to think about. And I think that certainly as time went on, you know, everyone, with the exception of the joint enterprise and that individuals, that is quite different. But I think that the people who, say, had been directly involved in a murder, there was something quite different between the reality of knowing that they'd done it and the psychological process of saying, you know, reflecting back and saying, oh, but I couldn't think of it and I couldn't talk about it. And, you know, it was also connected at that early stage to support. You know, for example, that there was a guy who had sort of spent 20 years denying his offence because he couldn't bear for his mum to know that he did it, and the implications of that. And when she died, he was like, okay, so now I'm going to start pushing forward with this, and I want to talk to you about this, and I want. So I think that realistically, by the time that individuals talk to us, I would guess maybe around the kind of the 8 year mark, somewhere between 5 and 10 years, individuals were, possibly because they'd started to come to the end of the appeals process and that had been exhausted, that people were starting to say to themselves, I am here, I can't deny, you know, this reality through trying to get out, and I'm unlikely to get out until my minimum time at least is up, so I need to start trying to think about about this differently. And part of that was that people started to say, actually, I have denied this for so long, as Ben said, because I can't believe I could be that kind of person. But now I need to think about that. There were very, very few who, by the time we interviewed them, who were saying absolutely flat out, I didn't have anything to do with it. This was nothing to do with me. And those that were, I guess, were the joint enterprise people who, like Susie said, had come around to thinking about it in a slightly different way.
I guess I was going to say that what makes sense to me is that people in the early years of their sentence, and we interviewed some people who had only been in custody for a few months, I think it made sense to all of us that for them there might be something quite, I don't know if healthy is the right word, but certainly quite psychologically productive in not having to fully contemplate at that point this dreadful thing that they had done or been involved in. And that just because the sort of very acute painfulness of finding yourself in prison with a 25-year minimum sentence and having been involved in this kind of act was just too much to bear, and that I think it took time for people that we interviewed who had served longer would say, you know, it took generally 4, 5, 6 years to even begin some of that process of really working all of this stuff through, so that in the early months and years, people's reactions to being imprisonment were quite, there was quite a lot of emotional incoherence involved in that. People often describing to us being incredibly angry, but not being able to identify exactly what they were angry about or angry with, or just saying, I'm angry with everyone, and I'm angry with myself and how my life has turned out, and I'm angry with other people. And if someone looks at me in the wrong way, then I just end up kicking off. And I think this perhaps goes back to the question about why the psychoanalytic terminology seemed to work. I think it was because what was being described to us so often was just being flooded with unmanageable emotions, and so I guess you could see how some form of denial within that time period might actually be kind of help people get through it. I think there were Susie and Serena will correct me if I'm wrong, but if I think about the people we interviewed who were at what we called the late stage of their sentence, so quite close to their tariff point or beyond it, I think very few at that point were denying in a kind of very significant way their involvement. So actually, most people seem to have got to a point where, I should also say that very few of those who we interviewed who were at the late stage had been convicted under joint enterprise, because that was not being used 20 or 30 years ago in the same way that it is now. And as Susie has said, I think that complicates the picture quite a lot. But I think generally people over time, what they described to us was a process of working through their own involvement.
That's really interesting, and that you can kind of see that there's an extra burden in terms of trying to work things out to achieve that. But I suppose, moving back to that question about denial, it sounded as if denial was kind of a phase that might suggest somebody had not yet come to terms with something from your work. And I suppose, having read some of the stuff more recently, that's been more recently, not more recent than yours, but more recent to me, about denial perhaps not meaning people are a risk, as rejecting that as being part of them. I suppose I've kind of thought of denial as being, if you accept that you're a murderer, you would then accept that you have that capacity to kill, and therefore you would take steps not to put yourself into situations where that might be risked again. Whereas if you deny it, then are you going to be able to protect yourself, prevent yourself from finding yourself in that kind of situation again? I suppose I was just curious about what your thoughts were on denial and risk.
And just to add to that, Ben, I think there were different ways that they tried to sort of process the offence within kind of who they were and their identity. So people would say, for example, that they were always a good person, but they just made one mistake. And that would be about, they drank a lot of alcohol that night, or they had addiction problems. And so that meant that they could kind of work on that particular aspect of themselves in order to, like you were saying, Naomi, not be someone who goes out and does something violent again. Because once they've sorted out their, alcohol issues or drug issues, then that sort of negates the possibility of violence occurring again. Mm-hmm. Or they would talk about, yes, they were a bad person at that point, but they are now working on themselves to become a better person. And through offending behaviour or education or faith, they'd found a sort of a way to narrate what they did so that they are a kind of consistent person, but they could very much feel that they were quite a different person to the person who committed the offence. Or the other way was that they'd sort of just matured out of that sort of offending behaviour, so that they, again, weren't likely to become violent again, because that was what happened when they were 18 and now they were 40, and that was, they're really unlikely to be in those situations and sort of be around those people and things like that.
Yeah, thanks very much for that. And of course, we've very quickly got into the meat of the detail of the study, which is a tribute to the way in which you are immersed in the material, I think. But it would be amiss, I think, if we kind of missed out on quite how the project started. So I wonder if you could just tell us what the project was exactly and how you began it.
Yeah, so it began, the thinking behind it began a really long time ago now. Ben and I were involved in a study comparing private and public prisons. And during that time, we were interviewing many men at the in a number of prisons. And we both sort of independently were struck by speaking to people who were serving really long life sentences. So I specifically, for example, remember interviewing a man who was around the same time as the same age as me at the time, so in his late 20s, and he was serving a sort of 20-25 year sentence. And I just remember being really struck by how long that was and what that would look like in my life, and all the things I expected to happen in the next 20 years, and for that this person was expected to be in prison, be in one building or a few buildings within that period. But Ben and I both found that people were often sort of quite resigned to those experiences, or, narrated them in a way that was in itself quite sort of unexpected, given how I was coming to think about these things. And at the same time, there's quite a lot of discussion amongst practitioners about this kind of growing group of young long-term prisoners and the changes to the high security long-term population in particular. There were some concerns. They were unsure about whether this population posed particular risks to disorder, for example, because there was worries that they would feel like they had nothing to lose due to their sentence length and their age. And there wasn't, it wasn't entirely clear how this population might be managed. It seemed like a very different sort of, or the population seemed to be quite different in terms of characteristics from previous decades of sort of life of populations. So Ben and I applied for funding to examine the experience of long-term imprisonment from a young age. And we were granted the funding and then obviously delighted when Serena joined the team. So we just, we were interested in the extent to which, or the experience of long-term imprisonment, how people adapted to the experience, how they coped with it, the way in which their relationships changed over time, the extent to which they felt that their experience was legitimate. So these were the questions that we kind of went into that first study looking at.
Brilliant. So you went to a number of prisons, did you, or just one or two? And you went to women's prisons as well, is that
right?
Yeah,
we went to 25 prisons, that's right, isn't it? 25 prisons over about 22 months. We sampled... We had a list of the people who were serving the sentences that we were interested in. So we sampled according to, you know, their characteristics. We particularly focused on people at the early stage because we were interested in the fact that this was this kind of part of this growing population of lifers. I think there's questions we're going to talk about later about the women's study, but just to say that with the women, initially we planned to do the men and women together as the same study, and we thought we would interview a proportion of the women, but there were such a difference in the numbers of women. So when we started the sentence, when we started the project, there was 789 men who were sentenced to life imprisonment with a tariff of 15 years or more that they got when they were 25 and under. And there were only 27 women. So in order to, if we'd have done a representative sample of those, we would have only interviewed four of the women. So instead we interviewed, we embarked on the kind of men's study, so the where we interviewed 126 men. And then once that study was finished, we then got additional funding and we purposefully wanted to go and approach all of the women because there were so few of them. And so we approached all of the women to be interviewed and surveyed, and about 70% of the women who fit the criteria took part in the study, either in interviews or surveys.
Thank you. Were you including people with IPP sentences?
No. Just life sentences, mandatory life sentences.
Lovely, thank you. Naomi, over to you.
Yep, sure. It was quite startling to read that the average tariff for a life sentence has increased between 2003 to 2013 from, I think you say, 12.5 years to 21.1 years. Is there an increased benefit to society of this? Is increased stay necessary to reduce risk, do you think?
Ooh. Well, so I guess there's part of that question, I guess, relates to kind of sentence length and potential reoffending among particularly people who have been convicted of murder. So perhaps Ben could take that on. Is it worth me saying something about kind of what we understand by a long sentence or what we mean by
long
sentence? I guess there's no kind of single or static definition of what long-term imprisonment means. And in fact, I guess it's very subjective over kind of time, space and place. So in the 1960s and the 1970s, very much kind of 4 or 5 years was considered to be a long-term sentence. You know, the Council of Europe in 1977 said that we would consider anything over 5 years to be long-term imprisonment. And at that time, kind of the end of the 60s, in England and Wales, we only had two men who had served more than 15 years continuously. which, you know, at that time would have been considered exceptional and barely survivable. And, you know, now, I mean, even among our own sample and the Freedom of Information request that we received recently, you know, even people serving 15 years or more from under the age of 25 is almost 1,400. So when you consider that then anyone aged 26 and over when they're convicted, those tariffs are massive. And as you say, Naomi, the way in which the average minimum tariff that kind of people were serving, you know, kind of went up by more than a decade in that short period of time. And I guess the, you know, why that's happened is probably something that we haven't really got time to cover here, although it's something that we talk about. Oh, sorry.
We'd certainly be interested to hear your thoughts on why that. I know that's not what your research was about, but obviously you've immersed yourself in studying long-term imprisonment. I can't think that you haven't thought about why in all your work on this.
Small plug, we did talk about it in our book, which is something that we have considered, I guess. So we, as part of the study initially, we planned to kind of conduct some studies with some interviews with staff and kind of senior personnel. And certainly, I think Ben had spoken to Phil Wheatley, who was the former Director General of the National Offender Management Service then. And he very much talks about this idea of currency, the currency of sentencing changing over time. And, you know, his kind of view was that these incredibly or increasingly long sentences had just become normalised. That, you know, previously, if say you'd read that somebody had got a 20-year sentence in the 80s, that you would sit back and think, gosh, you know, how are they going to do that? How can you survive that? You know, I guess now, and we have talked in some of our publications about the kind of the culture of control, about ideas around mass incarceration, political climates, populist punitivism, which I guess is the idea that that to appeal to a certain more maybe conservative with a small c area of the population, that politicians, the media, talk about kind of harsher sentences, you know, about being tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, not, you know, being very much against what they see as soft justice. I guess going back to Phil Wheatley, like essentially we've managed to, through that process, devalue the currency of what it means to spend time, to spend, you know, possibly for some of these young people, the sheer amount of time that they'd already lived to that point, again, in prison. Some of them were saying, you know, I've been 19 years on this planet and now you're asking me to do 25 years in prison. I've got no idea of what that time means. I don't know what that looks like. And I guess what it comes down to is what we see, not just as long-term imprisonment these days, but what we see as long enough. Through these various kind of processes, what is long enough, particularly for the sort of offences that we're talking about of murder, it seems that that too long just doesn't exist. And you can see that in some of the government's recent proposed sentencing reforms that sort of talk about extending whole life tariffs down to people who are still in their teenage years and haven't yet matured into full adulthood.
Thank you.
The one thing that concerns me about the increase in tariff lengths, in other words, the increase in the minimum amount of time that people will serve for a murder. And I should say that, you know, the main reason why sentences have got longer is to do with sentencing, you know, legislation. It's not, we can't find really compelling evidence that that this is to do with murders having become more serious, if that makes sense. The number of murders per year has gone up since the 1960s, but if we're looking at the last 20 years, it's not at all clear that the explanations for increasing sentence lengths are to do with much other than a kind of political response to a perception that the public want to see longer sentences, and we're a bit sceptical about that form of logic. But that what concerns me most about that is that you don't need to have such long tariff lengths in order to keep people in prison if you still consider them to be a risk. So I think what's particularly wasteful about 25-year, 30-year tariffs is that they don't give you the possibility of releasing people any earlier, whereas you could have shorter tariffs. In other words, you could have a shorter minimum sentence. And if someone continues to pose a risk to the public, and undoubtedly some people do, you can still keep them in prison for longer, if you see what I mean. So I think we've got things the wrong way round, where we're making it harder to release people at a point that would be sensible and humane. And what we're actually doing is prolonging the minimum amount of time that someone needs to serve in prison, even when they might have changed very significantly in a much shorter period of time. And so this is, this is mainly about retribution. And what's very difficult is, so the evidence about whether long sentences, about whether longer sentences might reduce the likelihood of re-conviction, that it's very inconclusive, that evidence. There's certainly no, it's certainly not the case that there's compelling evidence that longer and longer sentences will reduce reconviction. But in some senses, that isn't really the question that's worth addressing, because these long sentences aren't about rehabilitation. They are about retribution, and I guess sort of in some ways they're about vengeance or something like that. And my concern is that then becomes very elastic, because you could just decide, well, why not 30 years or 35 years or 40 years? And there are people in the system with those sorts of tariffs. And what's the point at which we decide that it's simply inhumane to lock people up for that amount of time, except in extremely exceptional circumstances? So as I say, my feeling, and I think Susie and Serena share it, is that we don't want to diminish the sort of gravity or enormity of some of the offences that we encountered when we interviewed people. It's just that having extremely long minimum sentences seems unnecessary when there are still mechanisms in place that allow you to risk assess people and decide that they might still represent a risk and should remain in custody, therefore.
Yeah, that perception of vengeance and retribution seems pretty distasteful as well, doesn't it, in terms of what it says about us as a society. And obviously America seems to be even further down that pathway.
Yeah.
But I suppose politicians are afraid of losing control of the process, handing it over to parole boards or psychologists or psychiatrists, and then facing embarrassment when something happens or somebody comes up for release who many people are shocked by.
I guess there are other ways of doing it. I mean, in criminology, certainly they talk a lot about Nordic exceptionalism or Scandinavian exceptionalism. We presented some of our findings at a kind of a mini roundtable that was organised by the embassy, the Finnish embassy in London, back in 2019, and that was to talk very much about the differences there between life imprisonment and serious offences in Finland compared to us. And it was quite interesting listening to the political kind of mechanisms in those countries, in which prison policy and the criminal justice policy, and Ben and Susie will correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that they are setting that 5 years in advance, that in some of those countries it sits outside of, where you look at kind of from Thatcher in the 1970s and onwards, very much the fight to be the party of law and order, whether you traditionally would have been on the left or the right, the way you've ended up now, everybody wants to be seen to be tough on crime because that's the vote winner. And so I think that it's you know, it's interesting to know that there are other models of doing this. There are ways in which prison policy, criminal justice policy can be separated out from the party political cycle in a way that is looking at what is best for people in the population who are not in prison and the people that have been separated from them in prison. And I think that it's quite interesting that that those ways exist, but I guess would probably not be countenanced here for some of the reasons that we've identified.
Yeah, I think we interviewed someone recently from Norway who spoke about how Norwegian culture used to emphasise the need for long punitive sentences, but actually people had grasped the mettle and made effort to do something different without there being this huge outcry. So it seems like it can be done. But I wondered whether your research might have any implications for what it's like for those serving IPP sentences. So although you weren't studying them, I think, you know, you seem to be describing a kind of like a realisation with a lengthy sentence that, you know, my goodness, I need to do something to get my act together in order to get out. And I wonder how that might look for somebody who's serving an IPP where they only have a very short tariff and, you know, what implications that has for them, really.
I mean, I think it's probably quite difficult for us to say. As you said, we haven't studied people serving IPPs, but I can certainly imagine that, you know, one of the ways that people, once they'd sort of gone past the early stage of feeling sort of emotionally lost and, you know, finding it difficult to even make sense of what was going on for them, they did have a sort of sense of how long they had to do particular courses or to engage in education or to sort of find faith that I suppose would sort of structure a sentence. Now, as Ben said, it's not that we think that, oh yeah, it's much better to have a 20-year sentence that you can structure than not have that, of course. But, and particularly, you know, what can you possibly do in 20 years to make yourself busy? You know, one of the problems is there's only so many times you can do thinking skills courses, or there's only so many degrees that are available to you in 20 years to do. But I can certainly imagine that having a sort of 2-year tariff without a sense of that, can, you know, having no sense of when you will actually be released, having no sense of when that end date actually is, that would make it really difficult to kind of feel like you can settle into that existential reflection of, okay, what do I want from my life? You know, who am I going to be on release? Who do I want to be? That must be very hard when you're living day to day, week to week, month to month, having no sense of whether you're going to be out when you're 25 or 35 or 45, you know, and not being able to make any plans or have any aspirations of who you want to be on release, because, you know, those things change from decade to decade, I'm sure.
And also, I guess in some work that we've been doing in more recently, or some writing that we've been doing, hopelessness comes up quite a lot. Just that Serena might want to say more because she's sort of led our writing in this area, but that once people get some sense that their pathway to release is blocked or that the obstacles are insurmountable, then there's a sort of precipitous drop in hope. People begin to disengage, or they feel the world out there is not for them. And I guess, as Susie says, we haven't interviewed IPP prisoners as part of this project, but it's very easy to imagine that they get to a point where they just become completely resigned to never being able to get out. I don't know, do you want to say a bit more about that, Serena?
Okay, thanks. With IPP, when you think that the paper that we're writing at the moment that is organised very much around the late stage, so as Ben said earlier, the late stage was really anyone who had less than 2 years to go till their tariff end, or who were beyond that point. And I guess that kind of post tariff kind of group ranged from a couple of months post tariff to 22 years post tariff. You know, there's a huge variation. And as Ben said, you know, there was this kind of point where, as time went on beyond the tariff point, that you know, I mean, we used Snyder's hope theory in trying to look at this, and this idea of kind of like goals and pathways and a sense of agency to get there are all essential to hope. And so the operation of hope that we saw in our late stage life sentenced men and women was very much subject to the kind of the institutional processes around them, as much as what might or might not be waiting for them on the outside, which of course very much depended on how long they'd been in. Somebody that had served, you know, 20 years or 15 years beyond their tariff, people, these people who were in their late 40s, their 50s, even in their 60s, family who had abandoned them, family, you know, who had died, that that they would, you know, we have one interviewee that we've quoted in this paper as kind of, you know, being in his mid 60s and saying, I've accepted that they're never going to let me out. And you know what? Don't feel sorry for me. I'm okay with that. I'm a realist. It's the equivalent of taking a monkey from the jungle and putting him in the city. Well, what is out there for me? And so I imagine that although that process is, you know, around the extreme amount of time, and when we're talking about what the utility is of these extremely long sentences, you know, that's something to think about, is the people at the other end of it. Going back to your question about IPP, and I'll give the same caveat as Ben and Susie, obviously it's not our area of specialism, but I imagine that if you have, say, an IPP tariff of 5 or 6 years and you orient yourself to that tariff point, and you think, okay, I need to get there. That's the soonest I'm going to be eligible for release. And after that, you know, there will, I imagine, and I don't know, because there's now a lot written about IPP, so you might not have the sense that there is an institutional process that is likely to release you if you play by the rules and you jump through the hoops and you do your courses. As each kind of month, and particularly each year, ticks down after the end of that tariff point, I can imagine that hopelessness and fatalism starts to come on in an exceptionally strong way that then probably makes it quite difficult to be motivated to push yourself, to develop the, you know, to push for the pathways, to build the goals, maintain that hope, to feel that you've got any sense of agency. I think it must be a pretty dire situation to be in.
Yeah, and it sounds to me as if helplessness needs to go along with hopelessness, really, the frustrations that arise around that.
Moving on, I think one of the things that was really nice about your work is the fact that you have made efforts to also talk about women's experience as well as men's experience, because that's so unusual, it seems, in looking at the criminal justice system. Can you tell us what you found out about the women's prisons and the women in them, and how that differed from the men?
Yeah, so as I said, we really wanted to include women alongside men. It's quite unusual to have both within the same study, so it enabled a really interesting sort of comparison, despite the very different numbers between men and women serving these kind of sentences. Because we did surveys and interviews, it sort of enabled us to look at a kind of quantitative assessment of kind of pains and problems, which we based on an old survey that we kind of adapted. And what was interesting about that was that overall the pains of long-term imprisonment for women were, in terms of scores, higher, and so therefore sort of we conclude acutely more painful. That's in terms of the sort of consistency across all of the scores, but in particular areas they were, you know, the pains were sort of ranked differently, and therefore we could see that they were more acute for women in terms of relative to other pains and problems. And so amongst the most severe problems for women was having to follow other people's rules and orders, missing loved ones, and worrying about people outside. And so we found that women struggled with the kind of multitude of ways that their intimate kind of daily lives were controlled. So not being able to choose what they ate, not being able to choose what they could wear, and not knowing whether they could have contact with their children, or if they could, when they could speak to them. And so we thought that this loss of autonomy was particularly difficult for women, in part because of their kind of pre-prison experiences of victimisation and abuse. So it's been said before that prison kind of reproduces the dynamics of abuse in terms of women continue to be kind of subordinated and infantilised in custody. There was also differences in terms of sort of relationships with loved ones outside. So while men talked predominantly about relationships with their parents, usually mothers, who kind of stuck by them no matter what, women sometimes had sort of strong relationships with their parents, but predominantly these had these were actually quite complex relationships that had either been severed or were complicated by histories of abuse, neglect and abandonment. So while men talked about their relationships with their mothers improving over time, which is something we can talk about later if you're interested, but the women were much more focused on, those who had children were obviously much more focused on their relationships with their own children. And this was understandably really complicated because the women's children were often in the care of, I mean, not often ex-partners, sometimes, but not often, but mainly extended family members or extended family members of their partners or in social care. So it meant that there were a really complicated set of gatekeepers that they had to gain access to their children through, and obviously often sort of court cases that were ongoing about, you know, contact and access and things. So it meant that for women, a lot of the pain associated with sort of missing their family was missing their children, but also worrying about their children and how they were getting on and sort of having a really limited access to their children. So for example, one woman described how her ex-partner had ripped up all the correspondence she'd sent to her daughter. So she was writing birthday cards and keeping them every year, and she was going to give them to her daughter on release, but her release was at least 15 years away. So this is a really long time to be away from children, and lots of other complicated issues around, for example, the child finding out about what the offence was, bearing in mind that these women were young when they went to prison. So often their children were very young at the beginning of these sentences, but obviously they were growing up alongside this sentence passing by each year. So it was really complicated to sort of maintain good relationships and maintain a sort of maternal role, which they felt that they often lost when they went to prison. It won't be a surprise to either of you that the women suffered severe mental health problems often. They suffered many of the same emotions that the men talked about in terms of kind of shame, anger, regret, grief. But these were often sort of channeled inwards for the women. So much higher rates of suicidal ideation and self-harm among the women. They were often struggled to think about the offence. As I said before, there was high numbers of the men and women were convicted using joint enterprise, but for the women that was particularly high, and often they were convicted alongside intimate partners of whom they'd experienced quite severe abuse and coercive control through. So they'd been in situations in which they'd been convicted for offences committed by people who had harmed them quite severely too, and that this was quite a complicated, it was quite complicated to come into terms with the offence itself, but also the circumstances of why they were there in the first place. And then I think another really significant point for the women was issues around trust. Again, because of their lives prior to imprisonment, trust had often been kind of corroded in cumulative ways. So people who ought to have cared for them didn't, you know, organisations, state organisations that were meant to protect them didn't. So they often had very low levels of sort of generalised trust. You know, we had examples of women who had been fostered, a woman who'd been fostered multiple times before the age of 14 and sexually assaulted in at least two of those homes before she was five, and, you know, went on to have multiple experiences of trauma at the hands of sort of many of the people that were meant to protect her. And so this meant that women struggled to trust when they were, you know, within custody, but they also ironically were really sort of really needed trust in intimate, caring relationships. And this felt really important to them. So they had sort of deep yearnings for intimacy and care, whilst also really struggling to kind of find people that they really genuinely felt they could trust. And I think women's prisons, you asked about kind of what it was like in the women's prisons. I think they would say, or they would describe them as often quite intense and suffocating in terms of sort of the relational gaze or something, you know, that that any relationship you had with anyone, whether it was a friend or an intimate partner, would very much be the content of, you know, comment and gossip. And, you know, so that meant it would be very difficult to kind of experience these relationships in a way that felt that you weren't under the gaze of many other people whilst you were trying to make sense of them and kind of decide who's trustworthy and, you know, things like that. So it meant that women's private lives were quite difficult to kind of maintain.
You could see how that could become quite claustrophobic, couldn't you? And we interviewed Lucy Baldwin recently, speaking about the experience of mothers, which was quite excruciating, actually, in terms of the sense of how painful that experience was. But you spoke a lot about kind of like women talking about their experiences of pain, and I wondered whether there were perhaps sex differences in terms of men and women being able to talk about pain, which might also have a bearing on sort of people being able to talk about traumatic histories.
Yeah, I guess certainly ostensibly there were fewer men, far fewer men who had, well, who reported to us the same sort of multiple cumulative experiences of abuse. That was a really consistent pattern with the women. That there were some men in our study who had quite similar sorts of biographical profiles, and our colleague Alison Liebling often says that the most vulnerable sort of, you know, 10% of men in prison, they have a very similar profile to the majority of women in prison in terms of these kind of multiple forms of trauma that they have suffered and so on. I guess what I think you and I had an exchange on Twitter about this, Naomi, and you said something really intriguing, which was, you know, maybe some of this is about how you ask questions in the right way, or whether people are actually disclosing, and I guess that's very hard. So it's really hard for us to know. I mean, I think my sense is that there just were fewer men who had the same experiences as these women had very consistently had. It's certainly possible that people held things back from us, but people did tell us, you know, people were pretty candid, it certainly felt that way to us, about things that had occurred in their lives. And certainly there were women. One of the really striking things when you look at the interviews with the women is that for some of them said that that the sentence was not by some distance the most traumatic thing that had occurred in their life, that actually the things they had experienced prior to their imprisonment, by which we mainly mean forms of sexual and physical abuse, but also things like losing children, babies dying or being stillborn and things like this, that these were more traumatic than the sentence, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. Whereas that was very, I don't think we heard that from many of the men at all. But it's, I mean, in some ways it would be quite good to throw this question back at you, because methodologically it's really tricky. It's very difficult to know whether men might be concealing these experiences because there are all sorts of norms around emotional expression that mean that perhaps they weren't telling us about similar sorts of experiences that they had had. I think we're all interested to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I suppose having worked with men and women in medium secure conditions and then men in the high secure estate, I see exactly the same patterns of, right, of abuse and neglect, and with multiple perpetrators being the norm. And I mean, certainly I've said on here before now, when we looked at the histories of sexual abuse within our population, over 60% had been sexually abused, and usually on multiple occasions, but over 52% of them had been sexually abused by a woman, for instance, and not a woman with a man, but a woman doing it of her own volition. And I think we looked at data on in terms of what we knew about the men that came into our service, and most of them had been in prison for very many years, been seen on multiple occasions and assessed numerous times, and then looked at what we knew 6 months later and found there was a statistically significant difference in terms of what we knew at that point than when they came to us. So there's some, I think there's something about men possibly take longer to build up trust, because it's, I think it's even more vulnerable for a man to, it's emasculating, I think, for a man, especially to talk about sexual abuse. But also, I think the way in which questions are asked. So we don't ask about abuse. We ask, how old were you when you first had sex? And because we're not asking about abuse, it kind of, so the, and then men would talk about, well, when I was 13, I had sex with a 27-year-old. Which, you know, if a woman was saying that, we'd quite quickly say, you know, that's sexually abusive relationship. But that doesn't get professionals don't talk about that as abuse when we're talking, but we're talking about little boys. So I think there's something about the kind of language we use, or men talking about having very strict dads, but actually when you ask them what their strict dad's punishment consisted of, you know, it would be, well, he came home from the pub in a bad mood and was drunk, and then beat me with his belt and used the buckle end of the belt. And again, I think kind of like asking neutral questions, I think, somehow makes it easier for men to talk about and reveal elements of abuse without having to worry that they're going to be met with pity from the person that's asking the question. But I don't know, David, if that's your experience.
It's slightly different, I think, because the culture in the, particularly the men's therapeutic communities, is a bit more, I was going to say robust, but that's perhaps glorifying it a bit more crude at any rate, not as sensitive. And I think, frankly, I think the Fens at Whitemore is probably the example of where you were able to go into this kind of work in such detail.
Yeah, so we were lucky to have people for a long time.
I mean, one thing about our study that's always bothered us a bit is, in some forms of prison research, you get to know the institution, and that means you spend a long time in one place and you get to know your interviewees over quite a long period of time. So you have conversations with them on the wings, and you might do a sort of informal interview just kind of standing around, and then you might build on that over time. One of the things that was very difficult in our study was that because of the way we wanted to sample the population we were interested in, apart from in a handful of prisons, I mean, there were prisons like Gartree, which only hold lifers, where we spent several weeks and the three of us were all there and we chatted to people in a more informal way quite often before we interviewed them. But there were other prisons in which we kind of turned up and had a chat and talked to our participants about the study, and we went through all of the issues around giving them making sure that they were able to give informed consent, but there wasn't that much time to build up rapport. Now, I think we not many interviews went wrong, if you see what I mean. I think we're all quite experienced researchers, and mainly it felt as though people opened up to us, but it's definitely not the same as when you get to spend a long time building up those relations of trust with people over a period of weeks. And so that's always, I'm not sure we could have avoided that really, but that's something that we've talked about quite a lot, the three of us, because it definitely isn't ideal to just kind of parachute into someone's life and ask them questions about these, you know, acutely difficult circumstances they're in, but also ask them questions about their personal background. It's far from ideal. We're just about to start, or fingers crossed, we're just about to start re-interviewing everyone from the original study. So we've received funding that allows us to do that. And once restrictions sort of dissolve a bit more, we'll be interviewing people both in the community, so people that have been released now and are in the community, but also people still in custody. And it will be 8 or 9 years since the first interview, so it's a slightly odd situation still. But I guess what we're hopeful, what we'll try to do is make sure that the original interviewer is the second interviewer, if you see what I mean, so that there's some consistency. And what we hope is that people, that even though it's a very long time period, that there is some kind of remnant of trust and rapport from the first interview that will help us find out more about what's happened to people in those intervening years.
Okay. That sounds like a really exciting opportunity. And I suppose I also want to add that, you know, they were talking there about trauma. I don't think that was the main thrust of what you were doing. And there's something I really enjoyed, the rich, I mean, you used the word texture earlier, and that really comes across from all of your writings, all the kind of like papers and everything. It really conveys a very rich quality to your research in a way that's not always there when people start trying to capture the experience of what it's like for people. You really see the individuals that you met with as people within the story that you're telling about what it's like to experience life imprisonment.
Thank you.
We still talk about, I mean, people, the interviews really stayed with us, and when we were all in the same place interviewing at the same time, one of the benefits of that was being able to debrief collectively, often, you know, over a drink, or, you know, we often were staying overnight, and we talked to each other a lot about the story, you know, about the people that we had interviewed, and you know, there's quite a lot of processing that goes on collectively in those situations, but also I think the people stay very much alive in our own heads, if that makes sense. And again, that part of that is that we've continued to talk to each other about the individuals we've encountered. Some of them have stayed in touch with us. So yeah, it really meant a lot to us in the book to try to because inevitably when you're trying to summarize a study this large, it sometimes feels like you're chopping people up into pieces. You know, you're quoting them, but a lot of the rest of their biography disappears. We were very key, you know, that's sort of necessary, but what we didn't want to do was completely lose the sense that these are individuals with very rich backstories. And so, I don't know, Serena, do you want to say something about the part of the book in which we try to represent their lives?
Yeah, I think the idea of pen portraits, which I guess I'd come across in an earlier piece of work when I was, in fact, the first thing I ever published, I was working with a friend of mine, Connie Holstein, who was working with in human-computer interaction, so something completely different to my area of work. And we wrote a study there that was about using research portraiture to kind of inform digital research design, and I guess I was bringing my kind of sociologically methodological kind of part to that, and she was very much bringing the design element, which I'm rubbish at, and I think that bringing those things together left me with this real sense of the importance of I guess that in psychology you guys will have your vignettes that are really crucial. Susie, I don't know whether you'll talk about this, but certainly the work that you did in the joint enterprise study with body maps and using testimonials, you know, this idea of bringing together the whole of somebody was so important to us. And realistically, I think if we could have, we would probably have also written a companion book that was of the research portraits, the pen portraits, because it felt so insufficient and problematic to us to reduce the people that we had interviewed, that we had met, to a few quotes. And I think just going back to the kind of the stuff about trauma, I think that, you know, the interviews that we had, they were semi-structured in the sense that we all asked kind of the same questions, more or less. But they weren't kind of, it wasn't a formal, let's sit down, we've got an hour, let's bosh through this and then we'll get out. You know, that some of the interviews took place over 2 days, over 2 sittings of, you know, 2.5 hours. You know, very rarely did an interview drop below kind of 2.5 hours, I would say. And so we did, well, Ben says it wasn't ideal by any stretch of the imagination, but people, including the men, were really very open with us. And as certainly what you said, Naomi, we did very much recognise those forms of abuse. The guys, particularly the older men, would talk about this extreme violence from often from male, you know, from men in their life, usually their father, that there would be, you know, what we would recognise as parental domestic abuse, certainly now. That some of them would certainly talk about and did disclose experiences of being sexually assaulted in a way that when they were younger thought, this is great, you know, here's this my mum's friend that's really interested in me and I can chat about this to the lads. And really, it's only later when they get to kind of somewhere like Grendon often, or the therapeutic unit at Gartree, that they start to realise maybe this is part of my story, maybe this is something, you know, that kind of happened. And so I think what we wouldn't want to do is diminish in any way those stories of certainly trauma and abuse that we heard. I think the slightly different pattern was that, you know, many of the older men, I guess, talked about the violence that would happen within the home, and sometimes violence on the street, and that was very much a feature of a lot of our younger participants. There were some who disclosed, particularly older men who disclosed sexual abuse in the home, some at the mid stage and the late stage. I guess the early ones were possibly just too concerned with surviving at that point. And maybe it was something about age and feeling comfortable and not having had the therapeutic input to be able to talk about those things, or maybe to want to talk about those things to say to Susie and I as women. We did find that there were kind of, you know, that the women that Susie and I interviewed, I guess it was this, that the abuse that they experienced within the home was, you know, was often physical, but was almost inevitably sexual, that it was from brothers, from friends of brothers, from fathers and uncles, and that was quite different to the men. That I guess that whereas the men would then often go on and be in relationships that where they would be, not always, but where they would describe being perpetrators and try to find what was going on in their life that had led to that point, because that wasn't always the case, that the women would go from one abusive relationship, you know, that they would, I think it was the nature of the violence as well. Obviously we had some of the young men that would talk about being shot and would talk about being stabbed. The women would talk, you know, by other men on the street. The women would talk about being kicked by their partner until they miscarried, being thrown out of plate glass window, having their head stuck into an oven by their partner who threatened to gas them to death. And so I think it was, and this relates, we did write about it in the book, I think, about what it means to have those experiences and then come into an institution where you are effectively powerless, and that powerlessness and a lack of agency is just reinforced every single day. But I think certainly just the one thing that becomes aware, whether you are in the women's or the men's estate, certainly from what you're saying about the secure psychiatric unit, I know the work of Gwen Adshead. I listened to her give an amazing lecture many years ago at the Guildford psychotherapeutic kind of annual lectures, and she's writing a piece for a special edition of the Prison Service Journal that Susie and I are co-editing. And certainly listening to the narratives of the kind of the men that end up somewhere like Broadmoor, maybe goes back to what Ben was saying about Alison Liebling's work, that there is, you know, the men that end up in secure psychiatric units, that their experiences possibly do very much mirror a significant portion of the women's prison population. And those, yeah, and I guess those things can be quite challenging to research.
Thank you. I've got an eye on time because you've all been very generous with your time, but there was just something else I wanted to ask as we come to an end. And Ben earlier on mentioned the pendulum, and I found my heart sinking somewhat as I wondered, well, where is the force coming from that will see the pendulum on its way here back again? But as we listen to you, and I think Naomi and I have had this experience on a number of occasions in these conversations we've been having, yeah, I come to feel that if the public really knew, not just on a factual level, but on an emotional level, about the kind of things that you've been describing, then, you know, that may bring about some change. That's the kind of information that needs to be spread abroad. But of course, it's extremely difficult to do that.
I think it's interesting because if you look at kind of research on sentencing, if you tell people details of an offender or a defendant in court, they are much less punitive than they are if you just ask them generally what their views are on how people should be treated in the criminal justice system. So I think, you know, you hope that part of the work that we want to do is that sort of public-facing dissemination that enables people to hear more about the lives of people in prison, because it's so far removed from most people's understandings of, I mean, you know, no, and even knowing what sentence lengths are or that joint enterprise exists, you know, many of those facts are lost on, you know, on many people. I think also, though, you know, Serena and I recently published an article in The Conversation, and, you know, you also do see the side who aren't so open to hearing these stories and being particularly sympathetic to them. So I think it is a huge feat, and it's difficult to know how to sort of really connect these sort of stories with people. You know, there are various ways of doing it, through creative methods or, you know, through other sort of dissemination, and we're sort of trying those things, but yeah, it is always really hard to know how to change hearts and minds and to really, really help and people understand what this means. And like I think Ben said earlier, you know, there is always the balance with conversations about victims and, you know, and what the public wants and what victims need, and I'm not entirely sure that we know what victims want or need in terms of justice, but that makes those conversations, you know, complicated, and it makes our contextualizing our work complex. But, you know, these are conversations that we're sort of trying to have all the time.
The Prison Reform Trust is currently, it's organised a kind of commission to look into both the experiences of victims of murder, but also people who have been imprisoned for murder. And their current Building Futures project is about long-term imprisonment. And what we're hoping is that, because they have so much more expertise than we have in terms of political engagement and lobbying, then I guess we have a bit of hope that that might make some difference in terms of, I guess, in terms of taking some of the heat out of political debates, but also better informing a wider public. One of the things that I've become, it's a slight niche preoccupation, but one of the things that really occurs to me is that most people's for many people, their only real sense of what people who have committed or been convicted of murder are like come from, I mean, there's obviously kind of media representations more broadly, but also often there are reports of what happens when people are found guilty or given their sentence. And what's often reported then is, you know, that the defendant swears at the judge or causes a commotion or kind of walks out of the court grinning and laughing. But those moments are really unrepresentative of what that individual is probably feeling either then or a few months down the line. So many of our interviewees talked about that moment, and it's a moment of profound shock. And often they were really embarrassed about the fact that they had, you know, started a fight or told the judge to whatever. You know, that they understood that was a reaction in the moment when they just couldn't contain a set of emotions. But also, as we say, I can't really think of anyone who we interviewed who talked with kind of remorselessness about what they had been involved in. And so I think no doubt there are a small number of people in that situation, but I guess one thing that concerns me is that people think that people who have committed murder are proud or indifferent, and that just is not at all, that doesn't correspond with our data, with our experiences at all. But that if all you've seen is a couple of 18-year-olds kind of grinning at cameramen as they walk out of the courtroom, or as they walk in or whatever, then, you know, that gives a really I wonder how much those sorts of things skew the public understanding of the nature and humanity of people, even people that have committed, you know, really terrible offences, if that makes sense.
Certainly Ben talks about, you know, that perception of remorselessness. I guess that was the flip side of it, wasn't it? Was that we would have those people who just sat there, and that it is, you know, reported in the media as, you know, the defendant sat there emotionless as the sentence was passed. The defendant sat there, you know, a blank face of remorse as they were convicted of the murder of, say, this child or this individual and sentenced to 25 years. And if only people could see what was happening inside those heads. You know, we had like young men who would say, the most important thing to me right then was that I didn't cry. I wanted to cry. My legs went to jelly. I thought I was going to be sick. I thought I was going to pass out. I couldn't stand up when the judge said to stand up. And all I could think was, my mum's up there, my sister's up there. If I cry, they're going to start crying, and I don't want that. I don't want them to be upset. I don't want them to be afraid for me. I need to be strong so that they think I'm strong. And, you know, if maybe at that time they're starting to, you know, they hear the sentence, and it's almost, again, it comes back to what we were talking about, those acute stress reactions that almost, you know, and again, how we got around to the psychological literature, that kind of that dissociative experience of feeling that you're about to faint, that the world is getting quieter and further away from you, and you're not thinking about what expressions on your face right then, you're not thinking anything except some, you know, just you're numb, you're absolutely overwhelmed. And if you're thinking anything, it's about impression management. Maybe you don't want to look weak, because if they play it on the TV and you're then in prison, that you put a target on your back for vulnerability. There's so much going on, but what, like Ben said, it is almost never, even when they're laughing or doing something that seems really distasteful and inappropriate and disrespectful to us, that is almost never their intention. There is so much more going on. I think that's one of the things we'd really like people to know.
Thank you. That's a really powerful description. And I think that's probably the place to end, actually. You've given us a tremendous amount of time and thought, and I think I'm very grateful. Mm-hmm. Have you got anything you'd like to ask at the end, Naomi?
No, I agree with you. I think that's such a powerful description, actually, of what's going on at that point in time. That seems a really good place to end, and really grateful to you, for all of you, for all of the time this afternoon. It's been such a thought-provoking conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been really interesting. You've asked us questions that are quite different from lots of the questions that we've asked ourselves and been asked by other people before, so it's been really interesting for us to reflect on all of these issues.
Yes, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was such a terrific conversation. I was really struck by the humility of them all, as well as their passion for the subject. I think in terms of what I mean by the humility, I think I found it quite special that they were talking about defence mechanisms and thinking about really quite deep psychological processes and making use of them in a way that allowed a really rich understanding of the accounts that they were getting from the people that they interviewed, and it really added this really rich texture to their research in a way that I don't think would have been possible without that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it was extremely powerful discussion and a whole lot of information, which was kind of weighed with feeling as well. So it wasn't just a dry account of their research, but some powerful tales of the encounters they'd had with men. And it's fascinating that they're planning to return and kind of repeat the study with the same men. That will be very interesting indeed. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.